Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with my guests for this hour, The Stranger's editorial director. Good to see you again, Dan Savage.
Hey.
Journalist and TV critic Melanie McFarlane. Hi, Melanie.
Hello.
Welcome back. Former Washington State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Welcome back.
Thanks.
We are live tweeting our show as always, so hop on at KUOW. Let's get into the top stories of the week now, again, with my panel here. First, the news update, the latest we know about this San Bernardino shooting is that the woman who took part with her husband had pledged allegiance to the Islamic State group and its leader on Facebook, and she deleted that message before the attacks. This U.S. law enforcement official says that Tashfeen Malik used an alias on Facebook. She was from Pakistan. She came to the U.S. last year on a fiancé visa before Syed Farouk married her in California. So that's what we know. That's what we know now. We asked you to tell us how you feel in a word or so, and we heard this.
Crazy.
Blasé.
Prepared.
Terrorism.
Frustrated.
Cynical.
Disgusted. Makes me embarrassed to be a human being. We can be so cruel and stupid and destructive.
Where are you right now, Dan Savage?
Flabbergasted. Are we sticking with one word?
Yeah, that's it.
Where am I on the San Bernardino shooting?
Yeah, I mean, geez, it's like pick a shooting. San Bernardino, Planned Parenthood.
It's nice that we're
Seattle calling Jewish it. Federation, Newtown.
It's nice that we're calling the San Bernardino, not nice, it's appropriate, it's being called terrorism. We should pass time that they should be calling the shooting at Planned Parenthood a form of terrorism and holding Carly Fiorina and Mike Huckabee responsible for ginning that up.
These are the videos taken out of context, edited videos of a
Planned Parenthood. And Carly Fiorina and Mike Huckabee have been running around the country saying it's baby parts, Planned Parenthood is selling baby parts. And the shooter goes to the Planned Parenthood office and when he's arrested says, I wanted to stop them from selling baby parts. Quotes Mike Huckabee and Carly Fiorina. There needs to be some accountability there.
So are you going right to the shooting and the context of it that gets your particular blood boiling?
What gets my blood boiling
aligning the
is the ease and the availability of guns everywhere.
No.
I tweet about it and I'm barraged with responses from quote-unquote responsible gun owners claiming that they are made to look terrible by these idiots who have access to guns and shoot up abortion clinics and their offices, Christmas parties. And my response to them always is, you would think the people most invested in there being a really high bar set for gun ownership would be responsible gun owners. That if we knew that you owned a gun and what we could infer from that was you were licensed, you were trained, that you were someone who could be trusted with a firearm, we would then infer from gun ownership, this is a responsible person that you would want around in an emergency. All we can infer from gun ownership right now when we see some idiot with a gun is that could be one of those idiots with a gun. That is, we have to assume that someone who is dangerous, for our own protection, we have to assume that someone who's dangerous. Because any idiot can get their hands on military-grade firepower in this country and shoot up an office, a daycare center, a school, a Planned Parenthood clinic, a Jewish Federation center. It is insanity. And it, as the president says, it's not like this in all other Western democracies.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna, what do you have to say?
Well, I think whether or not it's terrorism is important. You know, when the Paris incident occurred, and you had heavily armed jihadists, killing over 120 people. It raised the question of how did they get the weapons? You know, who trained them? Who organized them? Et cetera. If the incident in San Bernardino fits that model, we need to know that because it's tragic enough when someone who is mentally unstable, as we saw in Aurora, for example, or as we saw in Newtown, kills a lot of innocents. That we have to get on top of that in terms of how we address mental illness, for example, and standards for gun ownership. I think Dan's right about that as well. But if we're talking about an organized terrorist act, we need to know who else is here, who are they working with, et cetera, because this is quite different than madness. This is organized murder, right? And this becomes an important national security.
But we shouldn't accept the low-level, daily in-and-out thrum of gun violence in this country.
I completely agree.
Suicides, intimate partner violence. The average shootings in Las Vegas, this man went next door, shot a woman in front of her children, and then shot one of her children, and then shot himself. It didn't even make the news. Six people shot at a campground and killed. Didn't even make the news because it's just ho-hum, not terrorism, not ISIS, not brown people, nothing to worry about, nothing to see here. routine gun violence, and we just accept it and live with it, and it is obscene.
Melanie McFarland.
Yeah, you were asking what, in one word, I'm frustrated. And what I'm frustrated about is that there hasn't been any kind of political action or any kind of wider action at a larger level, a nationwide level, to do something about this. And I'm referring both to our gun violence epidemic and mental illness. It always seems that in the aftermath of one of these shootings, there's always a thing like, well, it's not the gun that kills people, it's the person. If the person is mentally unstable, it's okay, well, maybe do something about both. You know, there's all these statistics that come out after one of these mass shootings happened. The most distressing ones are that, you know, Black Friday gun sales went through the roof. That is absolutely alarming, because what exactly do the people who are purchasing those guns, what exactly are they prepping for?
Well, if they feel like they could get shot anytime at a holiday party.
So we need all these guns to protect us from all these guns.
Right.
Well, their theory is more about themselves than it is that they're solving a social problem.
My response to that is, if you're in a situation where suddenly there is lethal violence in front of you, even if you have a concealed weapons permit and you have a concealed weapon on you, do you have the tactical training to actually address that? Have you ever been in a situation where you have had violence or been under duress and been able to respond in that situation? Human beings in general, that's not, you can, there are stories of people who have, you know, high degrees of training in any kind of martial art or something like that, and still get mugged.
The cops.
So, I mean, that's the thing that really distresses me, is that the response in the aftermath after this is more guns and then no response in terms of doing something about it.
Can I just hear, as Rob McKenna agreed with Dan Savage about gun standards, I just want to give you a word about, I don't know whether you're a gun owner. I know all Republicans aren't alike. I just want to know from your point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I own a gun. A shotgun for hunting that I inherited. Never been fired as far as I know, but that has a lot of sentimental value. So I don't know if I really qualify as a gun owner or not. But I do think that it's a settled question that people in this country have a right to own guns. So I completely understand and respect the frustration that I'm hearing here.
People in this country have a right to abortion, and Republicans have regulated the hell out of that and made it almost impossible for many women in many parts of the country to exercise that right. I'd like to see the same restrictions and impositions placed on the right to own a gun that Republicans have placed on the right to terminate a pregnancy.
There is a fundamental right to own a gun that many Democrats as well as Republicans support. So if the implication is we just ban all guns, that's simply not going to happen. It's unconstitutional. You'll never get the statutes through or adopted that would be required. You'll not get a constitutional amendment adopted. The reason that gun sales spiked might be in part because people are worried about gun violence directed against themselves and want to defend themselves. It might also be because they're concerned that the government is going to take their right to own guns away, and they're going to go buy theirs now while they still can.
But I want to let someone who's not in the room speak for a moment. This is a mother of four living in Snohomish County named Zarbi Kakar, who says her fear has been on two fronts, as an American and as a Muslim. She says not long after the Paris attacks, this happened.
I was shopping, and out of nowhere, this man followed me from aisle to aisle to aisle, and finally came face to face to me and said, "You are responsible for the death of my mother." And I looked at him and I said, "Excuse me, what are you talking about?" He said, "You people killed my mother in the war." I don't know. I'm only assuming maybe his mom was in the military, maybe his mom. But he came and attacked me, and he had one of his hand in his pocket. And at that moment, I didn't know what was in his pocket. I literally stopped everything and just walked out of that store.
And Zarbi told us that since the shooting in San Bernardino, her fears have gotten worse. And see if I can bring you that. Okay, this is what she said.
Honestly, I am attached to the TV and hoping and praying with all my heart that it's not a Muslim. Because when it is a Muslim, it affects each one of us all over the world. Yesterday and today was the saddest day in my 30 years of living in the United States, that I had to tell my daughters to adjust what they were wearing. And I asked them to put on hats instead of scarves. I was worried whether they were going to be attacked because of how they were dressed. as a mom, this is with great sadness that I came home. I was literally sitting there at the bus stop, and on my way home, I was driving with tears that today I have to go through this here in a country where you find safety and security. And I feel like that's not there anymore.
Thank you to Zarbi Kekar for talking with us on KUOW. Any final words about shootings before we talk about the other things that thankfully also are in the news this week?
I do want to say one thing just to address Rob. Mm-hmm. You are, sadly, you are probably right that it's not going to change, and that's the root of my frustration. But in other countries, they have managed to do something about gun violence. You can say that there's all kinds of differences in terms of, you know, why there is that citizens cannot own handguns in the United Kingdom and in Japan, or after, you know, the fact that there haven't been any mass shootings since 1996 in Australia, because there was, the prime minister stood up and said, we have to do something about this, and the citizens reagreed. And, you know, so, but this is a problem that we actually have to have politicians stand up and say, you know what? We have to stand against this. This is an epidemic, and it keeps on happening.
Stand against the epidemic of gun violence? Or do you mean
standing against the rampant ownership of guns in this country? Yeah.
You're doing that thing that conservatives do when you talk about legalizing marijuana. They go, oh, what about heroin? No one's talking about banning all gun ownership.
No, I think some people are talking about. I think Melanie's talking about banning.
No,
what
do you want to call for?
You can own a gun in the United Kingdom.
But
not in Japan.
It's regulated.
Let's find out.
Regulated.
What regulation are you calling for right now, Rob McKenna?
Well,
what do you want?
The first and most important thing to address is access to guns by people who are mentally ill, which means improving the background check system that we have in place, which is flawed. That has to be strengthened. I would start with that, show that's efficacious, that it works, and then look for other steps that need to be taken.
Unfortunately, sometimes we only find out that someone with a gun is mentally ill after they shoot up a school, before.
And they could still obtain a gun from somebody who has legal ownership, who went through all of those.
My point is simply that we baked this into the Constitution initially. It's been upheld repeatedly. And this is not just a matter of legalism. This is a right that
baked slavery into the Constitution.
This is a right that many people in this country hold dear. You can change the Constitution. Absolutely. It could be changed. Part of our civic dialogue and our political system should be a conversation about what should be kept and what needs to be changed. I don't disagree with that. I'm just suggesting to you there are a lot of people who believe it's very, very important that they continue to have the right to possess firearms. Mm-hmm. So it will not
including the very well-funded NRA. And there are many gun owners who will not be
who
in the
are
NRA,
funded by millions of Americans who pay dues to the NRA.
And there are a lot of people who once upon a time believed it was very important to them to continue to own people.
Look,
and they had to
we all get that you guys disagree with the people who think they should have a right to own guns. I'm just observing that they have a view also. And they will stand up, they will be politically active, and they will stymie efforts to take their own rights to own guns away.
Okay, team, I hope we never talk about this again. I'm skeptical, but thank you. This is The Strangers, editorial director Dan Savage. We have Melanie McFarlane here, journalist, writes at McTelevision, and the former state attorney general Rob McKenna, continuing to talk about the news of the week when we come right back. Live tweeting this show at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us. The University of Washington has one of America's great rowing programs. Its crew teams win world championships and gold medals. Its women's crew coach, Bob Ernst, has been there since before I was a Husky, before Rob McKenna was a Husky, more than 40 years. He's won 8 national championships, and last week, the university fired him. Sports writer Jeff Baker is here from the Seattle Times. Welcome, Jeff.
Good to be here.
The university finished a 2-month-long investigation into crew coach Bob Ernst. What sparked the investigation?
Well, on the first day of classes in September, Ernst and his pretty successful coxswain got into a heated argument in his office. I mean, she had apparently gone to him. She had been at national team tryouts earlier this summer, had been exposed to different kinds of coaching. She had, from what we've been told, gone to him and suggested he perhaps be a lot more communicative with his athletes, a little softer in how he addressed some of them. And from all accounts, that conversation didn't sit in all that well with the coach. And then during his opening address on the first day of classes to his rowers, he caught her glancing at a cell phone, and that irritated him quite a bit. And they ended up having a discussion in his office afterwards. Things deteriorated, and depending who you talk to, she either quit the team or got thrown off the team by him. It just depends. You know, there's been various accounts told to university officials, but she was off the team. And from there, she complained to administrators about his style, about his approach, and administration went and did an investigation and interviewed something like 24 current athletes and a handful, I'm told, I think it was 4 former athletes from recent graduates who were brought in to talk. And they painted a picture of a man who ran, depending on, again, on who you talk to, a dictatorial type of coaching regime, which isn't all that unusual in Division I college sports. I played football up in Canada when I was younger. I can tell you our coaches were all dictators. But, you know, in this case, there's some real debate about whether, Bob Ernst's style went too far and whether, you know, being a bit of a tough love kind of coach ended up becoming an abusive type of coach.
Well, what was the fireable offense?
There wasn't any one offense in particular from everybody I've spoken to. There wasn't any one thing. There was talk that he was making his rowers feel compelled to skip classes in order to get extra practice sessions in if they wanted a ride in the Varsity 8 boat, which is the big coveted prize amongst crew members. There was talk that he might have made fun of the weight of some of his female rowers, and that's become a sensitive issue in more modern times than it was, let's say, 30 years ago. It's definitely a lot more, there's a lot more education about that kind of stuff. So there were complaints that he was not only, making quips about their weight, but actually mocking some of them. It really comes down to interpretation. I've spoken to rowers who left the program as recently as 2 years ago, and they say that, Bob Ernst was very tough, yes. But we appreciated that, and when you get a little bit of distance between rowing right now and maybe 2 years later, when you look back on it all, your perspective might change. Whereas, when you're sitting in the boat exhausted every day now and going home, you might be thinking a lot differently about your coach. And that's, I think that's where we're running into some of the issues here, where we're seeing arguments amongst generations.
Yeah, okay, right. So I hear two things going on. There's the generational, the way they did it back then, the way it's always been. Some of the former athletes suggested that kids are coddled today, right? And then you have the dictatorial, tough love versus bringing out the best versus riding somebody too hard. What have you learned about those gray areas in reporting them?
Well, I mean, that's part of the issue. I mean, I've spoken to, believe me, I've been between the last few days and today, I've heard from athletes of just about every decade going back to the 1950s who rode at UW or did some kind of sports at UW. And, a lot of them are saying, we put up with this kind of stuff all the time as athletes. The one thing we don't know is we weren't inside that shell house with those athletes. We weren't out on the water with them. We don't know exactly what was said and the tone that was used and how harsh it got. But, I mean, the one thing I know from covering professional sports for many years is that and college sports at a D1 level can start to verge on the professional aspect of it. It's not supposed to, but it does nowadays. That's the reality. Coaches can be very harsh on their athletes, but some of the best coaches I ever had growing up, were extremely harsh on me. They called me every name in the book, but,
name one.
I'm not going to name them here. I can tell you what. When I was 8 years old, I had a coach in Canada named Jeff Cimboli, who after we actually had to walk off the field during a game, he was embarrassed. He lined us all up against a chain link fence, and he made us take runs at that fence and try to knock it down for a good solid half hour. We never did knock the fence down, but, I mean, he was trying to tell us, what happened on that field is not acceptable. And I'll tell you what, you ask anybody.
You didn't knock the fence down?
We did not knock.
Sounds like you're a loser.
We were 8 years old, but you talk to people.
An eight-year-old loser.
You talk to people who have gone on and played college and pro ball, and some of my ex-teammates did, and they will tell you that he was one of the best coaches they ever had. He instilled discipline, mental toughness in them. That's one example, and that's like, as an eight-year-old, that doesn't mean anything. You're talking here about D1 sports, very different subject, but it's a very sensitive thing. And athletes today versus athletes yesterday will have entirely different views on how things are supposed to be approached. Now, having said all that, from what I've been told and from what we knew going into this, the intention of these athletes wasn't to get the coach fired. And indeed, the administration was not going to fire him.
They gave him another chance.
And depending on who you talk to supporters of the coach, they'll tell you that he felt ambushed by this meeting. They had a meeting on the Friday before Thanksgiving in which, you know, it was kind of a hastily arranged thing. They were supposed to meet the next day. He ends up going into the shell house, gets confronted by all their allegations. Things get a little testy towards the end. He ends up storming out and then sends them an email saying, you know what, I'm still your coach. The way this was handled wasn't right. I'm going to stay on and be your coach. And that didn't go over well with the crew members who ended up contacting the administration, and he was fired two weeks later.
Yes, I want to hear how the panel reacts to this. Melanie? Start with someone else? Is that what you're saying?
I'd say start with someone else. I was never a part of organized sports.
Were you coddled?
I was.
Are you soft?
I was never coddled, and I was never sent to. I was in the Chicago Children's Choir, and we were never sent to run against a chain link fence when we missed our notes.
Dan Savage, you look like you work out a lot.
I don't care about sports.
Were you an athlete?
I do remember. No, I was never an athlete. But now I'm a snowboarder because I live in Seattle, and you have to be. I do remember that I had a science teacher in junior year of high school, or sophomore year, who was terrifying, and everybody hated him, and nobody wanted to be assigned to his classes. He was the worst science teacher. He screamed and yelled. He threw things at people. He was terrifying. And you learned so much in his classes, and as soon as you were out of those classes, you were like, he was the best teacher I ever had.
Wow.
Even though it was traumatic to get your schedule and see his name. People were in mourning.
You've got a kid. Do you want your son to have that traumatic, wonderful teacher?
No, of course not. I'm a wimpy, white, liberal Seattle parent.
Rob McKenna, you're not a liberal anyway.
It doesn't sound like that it was the rowers who got him fired. It sounds like the athletic director decided after years of friction with Coach Ernst that he should go.
Yeah.
I'm not saying this is pretext, and it may be that he stepped over the line in some regards, but it sounds like this might have been more of a fight within the administration than anything else. Having said that, one of the most interesting things about this story, I think, is the contrast between the views of athletes like Kristen Thorsness, who won a gold medal in rowing in 1984, and some of the younger athletes, which you guys alluded to earlier. She said in the article, was he hard on us? Absolutely he was. Did he rub some people the wrong way? Absolutely. But it's all about helping the athletes to find it within themselves to give their absolute best. The things he taught us helped so many rowers go on to be successful at other things in their lives. So, 30 years later, she's got a very interesting and important perspective that differs perhaps from some of the rowers who are in the middle of it right now.
Yes.
And I think maybe it's generational too. What do you think, Jim?
Well, I hesitate a little bit to jump onto the generational bandwagon, even though, let's face it, that's why people are clicking on the story today.
That rower was checking her cell phone while he was giving
that's season
opening.
Over well with an old school coach anywhere. And I don't think anybody's going to disagree with that. But that said, I spoke to Ruth Wyman, the other day, who lives in England right now. She raced only 2 years ago for Bob Ernst. She's gone on to become a silver medalist for Great Britain at the under 23 World Championships. She's injured right now, but she's going to be going for the Olympics in 2020. This is an elite world class athlete. She was a former junior world champ and only rode there 2 years ago. And she said much the same thing that Thorsness was saying, from her 30-year perspective. After 2 years, what Wyman was telling me is that, her perspective might have been very different 2 years ago sitting in the boat on the water. But now that she's had time to look at it, she realizes what an impact this coach had on her life. And I think that's the important thing to remember. We can be dictators in sports, but you have to at some point show the athletes that you care what happens to them as people outside once they leave your program. And from everybody I've spoken to, they say that Bob Ernst really did show that he cared about what happened to his athletes after he stopped rowing for them. And maybe where this gap is occurring with the current athletes is they're not sensing that same level of care about them as human beings. And maybe they don't have that perspective yet to find out. I don't know the answer to that.
They're not human beings, Jeff. They're athletes. And we've got to bring them to their best so they can win the gold, so they can capture the brass ring. and then feel good about it 30 years later after the trauma has subsided.
After the trauma, or after they've gone on to become rich and successful as business people because of the same discipline.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Baker, Seattle Times. Thanks for telling us about the end of the career of the Husky, legendary Husky women's crew coach, Bob Ernst. We appreciate it, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
KUOW's Week in Review, back in a moment. Did a Seattle CEO really raise all of his employees' minimum wage to $70,000 just because it was the right thing to do? Well, this week, a Seattle journalist reported that Dan Price has something to hide. Quickly, to remind you, he is the CEO of the credit card processing company Gravity Payments. He cut his own pay and raised the minimum wage for his workers to $70,000 a year. Dan Price of Seattle was a national celebrity this year. He went on The Daily Show talking about striking a capitalist blow for equality.
Our system is set up to incentivize me as a CEO to try to suck out as much value, pay everybody the least amount possible, charge everyone the most possible, and take the most for myself. And does that system actually lead to the happiest life? And I would suggest that some of the most successful companies out there actually had something that was really magical called love. And love is a rational force that can overwhelm some of these economics and create like this new economic reality that we're going to.
This is insane. So basically...
Only insane?
If I'm understanding that this is what I'm being presented with right now. So you are a young man who believes in sharing with others, and you have long hair and a beard, and you preach love. Have we met before?
Wow. Dan Price, CEO and preacher from Galilee. Overstatement? Well, I talked to a reporter with Bloomberg Businessweek. Karen Wise told me that Price actually downplayed some inconvenient facts. For example, Price told us that his brother had sued him. His brother's a minority shareholder in the company. And Dan Price had said his brother sued him after Dan Price raised everybody's salary without his brother's approval.
In the course of my reporting, I learned that the lawsuit actually came a month before the wage hike, the pay increase for employees. And that kind of challenges the narrative that Dan had said to me and to other reporters that kind of said that it was a reaction to it. Instead, what you have is the brother essentially saying he's greedy, and then he goes out and does this kind of magnanimous, altruistic move. So why the connection is, I don't fully know. He has hinted at the potential negotiating powers that could give him in the lawsuit. And also, I do think it has helped him publicly kind of as this kind of underdog that people want to kind of support and back up. I think the reality is inequality is a huge problem in our country. And I think a lot of people were really excited to see a new CEO doing something about it. But his pathway to doing it is not quite as clear as people knew.
So besides the timing of this lawsuit, what else led you to the conclusion that his altruism may not be what it seemed?
One of the claims in the lawsuit was that Dan overpaid himself as CEO. And in a lot of the press coverage you see, they talked about how he took a 90% pay cut to pay for this the wage increase for his workers. He took his salary from over $1 million down to $70,000 like his coworkers. And when I looked at comparable pay rates for other private companies, I found that $1 million would be very atypical for a company of Gravity size. It has about 100 employees based in Ballard. And they do, you know, they're very excellent employees from what I can tell, very hardworking, try to serve their customers very well. But it's not a huge revenue business. It's not a hugely profitable business. And the pay that he was getting would be more in line with a significantly larger company than it is.
Everybody doesn't get paid the same. What's the big deal if he was doing great?
So it's if you own your own business by yourself, that's one thing. If you have a shareholder to answer to, that's another thing. And he does have a minority shareholder, and that's a question that the court will deal with at some point in the future.
That's Karen Wise, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, telling you about Dan Price's possibly conflicted motives for making his minimum wage $70,000. And not only that, she also told us that Price's ex-wife is claiming he physically abused her, which Price denies. You can hear the whole interview at KUOW.org. I saw you nodding your head, Rob. How did you react to hearing that Dan Price might not be Jesus?
I was relieved. Yeah, but no. On the issue of the story, it's a brilliant bit of reporting to dig up the fact that he came up with the idea after he was sued in a suit that claims he's overpaying himself, as opposed to his narrative, which has been he came up with the idea before the lawsuit was filed. So the reporter has done what reporters should do, has gotten the facts, confronted him with the facts, and made him look pretty foolish in the process.
But you sound less disappointed than you are gleeful. How do you feel about this?
You know, it's in a way, it's too bad because it's been such a great story, right? This guy who seems idealistic has decided to make this decision to pay everyone more fairly in his company. On the other hand, when you stop and think about someone who leads a company of 100 people, paying himself over $1 million, you know, when he's got a shareholder, that's obviously a bit more troubling.
I'm trying to get at the feeling we have, because some people thought $70,000 minimum wage, it's a new model for capitalism. And some people thought, this is the last thing we need. You're just overpaying people. And then your celebrity makes the rest of us seem like we ought to be paying people anything.
Well, two thoughts on that. Number one, it's partly his company, partly someone else's company. So they should get to do what they want to do in that regard, right? If he thinks that's a good business decision, or he just thinks it's the right thing to do, more power to him. Number two, you have to give him credit for either stumbling into the most brilliant media strategy or coming up with it in a calculating fashion, because the amount of press he's gotten has been phenomenal. The question is whether or not that ends up making the company more successful, and that remains to be seen.
Right. Dan, you care?
Yeah, he looks like Jesus. I don't know
right?
if it was a conscious choice on his part.
A little is, Brad Pitt thrown
in. He looks like Jesus in an MGM 1950s version
yeah,
of what
that's
Jesus
true.
Looked like, I suppose.
Sword and Sandal movie.
Yeah. Cocky, Cajun-y, honky Jesus. It is true, though, you know, the larger issue I think that this story was tapping into, and the reason it took off, is that wages have been stagnant for decades. We have 5% unemployment, which is typically referred to as full employment, and wages are not rising. Corporate profits are higher than they've ever been. Corporations have stuffed money into bags that they aren't reinvesting, and they also aren't sharing with their shareholders or with their employees. And we've lost sight of the fact that labor is a form of capital. And people who work at McDonald's have a right to a living wage, and we shouldn't be subsidizing Walmart, that corporation, and the billionaires who own it, but with food stamps and welfare assistance so they can continue to pay their employees below subsistence wages, that there needs to be a kind of economic, cultural, corporate reckoning with the system that we have now, which is pay people as little as possible, return as much as you can to the shareholders, and have a robber baron as your CEO, and that's our system. And it's not sustainable, and that needs to end. And I think that's why this story took off, because people, I think, consciously or subconsciously intuit that this is the problem, that people work and work and work, and somebody at the very top is made to be obscenely wealthy, and everybody else scrapes along at or below a living wage. And that has to change. Go,
Melanie. So then learning about his conflicted motives, his allegedly hitting his wife, which he denies, does all that, how does all that affect how we think about what capitalism could be, which was the juice behind the story in the first place?
I think in an ideal world, those would be two separate issues where, like, yes, you do have a CEO who is deciding that he's going to make sure that his employees are well compensated. Unfortunately, the impression that I get from this is that this is someone who is even look at the photos of him in this article, very, very much aware of his image, particularly in social media. There's the whole idea of people reacting, oh, yum, this guy's yummy, you know, and that part of it makes me really, it's almost, this is going to be simplistic, but when I read it, I was thinking of, like, you know, this reminds me of those guys that I used to meet in college, like, yeah, I'm a feminist. And then you hear that they're just doing horrible things to women on a personal level. This is a person who just seems to be taking something that should play well in the public and using it to his own advantage more than doing something out of the goodness of his heart as an example for other CEOs to follow.
But I bet his employees are still psyched about the 70K.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Meanwhile.
Yeah. Yeah. But the bigger question is, like, what kind of impact is this necessarily going to have? Is this the kind of guy that on other, you know, and other with other businesses of this level, other CEOs are going to be like, you know what, this is a good example, I'm going to follow it. Is his personal life going to even get in the way, or will it have an impact at all? It seems like, if anything, it's more his employees. I'm sure his employees are absolutely joyful at being able to, you know, live on $70,000 instead of the, what, $30,000 to $40,000 that they may have been making before. A couple of people said that they would have been their salaries had effectively been almost double. That's mm-hmm. great. But in terms of whether that's to kind of clean up his own image or out of the goodness of his heart, that's the big question.
And one of the things the reporter says in the story that it might end up doing is making it impossible for the company to buy out the brother who's
right.
suing.
Right.
So it might have been a tactical move
exactly.
to block
yes.
out his brother's lawsuit.
Right.
It's a fascinating and very incriminating, I think, story.
Yes. And it's on newsstands this week, Bloomberg Business Week, talking about, I think the headline was that Dan Price has something to hide. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. Jesse Jackson, George Washington, and shrinking local media coming up. With Dan Savage, Rob McKenna, and Melanie McFarland, I'm Bill Radke. How do we honor our past when our past wasn't always honorable? I talked this week to civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson about the modern racial protests on campuses, including Western Washington and the University of Washington. I played him tape of Husky senior Pauka Shabale telling me she feels oppressed and intimidated by the school's treatment of students of color, and one example is the big George Washington statue at an entrance to campus.
In the black community and the interactions that George Washington had with the black community was through slavery. And he is being worshipped and praised at the University of Washington because he was the first president of the United States.
That George Washington statue is big, right, as you enter Red Square. We're not just talking about a plaque. Do you think the statue should just come down?
You see, that's a decision to be made at this level. But let me submit to you that when you have the statue and up on it, the lettering, the writing extols upon him great virtue and does not mention slave master, does not mention the support for a crime against humanity. That's a big piece of it, too. At least educate people as to who this guy was, you know. Now, in some instances, people want to pull the statues down. Some other instances, people want to preserve the statue and, in fact, inscribe the character. It's the tension of our times, still learning how to live together.
George Washington, first president of the United States, slave master, on the plinth, on the statue.
Yeah. At least you know where he is.
This is a serious conversation also happening at Princeton University, where they're talking about removing President Woodrow Wilson's name from a school and a dorm complex. Let's start with George Washington. Melanie, remove the statue, add to the statue, leave the statue alone?
This is my point of view individually, and I'm not speaking for black people as a whole. But at some point, you just have to kind of look and say, how far do we want to go with this? Now, the founding fathers of this country owned slaves. And if you don't know this by the time you, and you're not completely aware of this by the time you get to the university level, that is appalling. And that is more, I would think that the bigger issue is making sure that history is not whitewashed in our elementary schools and in our, you know, our primary education. There was that instance with the McGraw-Hill textbooks that was brought to light in October where slavery was characterized as part of immigration and migration.
Workers.
Coming over, workers migrated over from Africa to help us build this country. No, that is not what, and pointing that out, and McGraw-Hill saying, well, we'll change it on the electronic textbook level, and eventually we'll change it in our the physical textbooks, but that's going to take a decade. So this is something that's a bigger problem.
And they did that because conservatives are constantly mau-mauing textbook companies about seemingly unpatriotic or making the country look bad. So you just know that they were trying to get out ahead of conservative criticism by downplaying how all these Africans wound up
exactly.
in the colonies in the first place.
Exactly. And even more than that, I mean, and when I say on a systematic level, you know, I recently just read there was a teacher who received an honor, who was featured in the Washington Post. And one of the things she pointed out was 80% of the educators that our children will encounter during the course of their primary education is that they're going to be white people, largely female, and they're going to be teaching from textbooks that really teach the perspective of, you know, a largely white version of history. So it is really up to the individual educators and the individual schools to make sure that that's more balanced out, to actually reflect that, yes, people of color also had a role in this country, not just through labor and slavery and other types of servitude, but also through innovation, also through contributions to culture.
Okay.
Those are the things that I think should be, is that's more important to me,
yes,
than what's going to happen to a statue.
You're saying a bigger issue is how we learn about this from a young age in school. I still wonder, Rob McKenna, what we do with historical figures who were great leaders and committed crimes against humanity and all kinds of things in between.
Well, I don't think that George Washington's statue is on campus to celebrate the fact he was a slave owner.
You can't tell by looking at it.
We know why it's there. It's there because it's the University of Washington, named after Washington State, which is named after George Washington. And I think there's a risk that if this becomes the central debate, should Washington's statue stay or go?
It's not central. It's just an example.
Right.
Go on.
But it will become the central issue. It'll become a distraction from the extremely important issues which are being raised by students of color at the UW, who find that it's still not a comfortable place for them to be. And this one student is citing the statue as a factor, but there got to be other factors as well.
We talked about much more, the curriculum, the faculty,
sure,
safe
so
spaces.
That's where I would put the energy.
Okay.
And I think those voices need to be heard because those are the voices that matter. I can't relate to the experience of a person of color, a student of color at the UW, because I wasn't one. But if that's what they're saying in numbers, then that needs to be heard and needs to be addressed. And I think that the university is beginning or has been taking steps to do so, as the current president has recently announced.
Okay, coming up, consolidation in the air. And we have some media folks right here to tell you about it in just a sec. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, with the stranger, Dan Savage, is here, your former attorney general, governor candidate, Rob McKenna. Melanie McFarland is a journalist, a TV critic, writes at McTelevision. Hey, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
There are fewer of us all the time. Let's talk about consolidation. First of all, we told you earlier this hour about Group Health being bought by Kaiser Permanente of California. In the media, you probably know that KUOW is acquiring KPLU. And then this week, KCTS Channel 9 says it's merging with the local news site, crosscut.com. Dan Savage, you are a local media poobah. You're
setting the poobah bar really low, but go ahead.
The stranger,
Frank Blethen, smoking cigars at the Sorrento Hotel.
Stranger survived the media shrinkage. You're in print. You're online. How do you feel about our media buying and merging?
It's distressing. You want there to be many voices and not fewer voices, and consolidation is problematic. And I would posit that KUW isn't merging with KPLU. You're putting it down.
Acquiring.
Putting it down. Putting a bullet in its head, which is
wow,
a little different than a merger.
Well, to make it clear, there'll be two separate stations. Instead of one station doing news and one station doing a mix of news and music, it's news channel here, music channel there.
But you also had two different newsrooms covering different stories.
Yes.
And not all of those reporters from KPLU are going to make it over to the KCTS staff.
To what, KUOW staff.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't know how many people will make it over. But as you said, you were telling us that the real story happens. That's how the real story happens, is what actually occurs.
Right, what actually occurs. And then the thing about it is, and the thing to keep in mind, is that what happens now is just the period where the two staffs merge. What's going to be really interesting is to look and see what happens a year from now, when all of the financials and all of the things that went into the initial merger kind of settle. That's the thing that's going to be really interesting to keep an eye on.
By the way, I should say, former Seattle PI columnist Melanie McFarland.
I also work for the Seattle Times.
And the Seattle Times.
Yeah.
Anybody remember the PI?
Ha ha.
You're right.
Well,
so what's your perspective on that? Like, so you've been in Mergerville and joint operating agreement, and
right,
then You know, and then goodbye the PI in print and all that. So what happened?
So it's a bit of a different situation. I will say, getting to the Crosscut KCTS merger. Mm-hmm. I think with KUOW and KPLU, you again had newsrooms with competing reporters competing for the same stories. You also had a variety of voices. So that also meant that if you had different reporters covering the same story, you could actually get different kinds of information, theoretically, depending on what the story is. That was the same thing that we had when we had two daily newspapers in this town with the Times and the PI. And you also had different political perspectives. Depending on who you are or what kind of reader you are, you may have looked at the Times as a more conservative paper than the PI was. Some people would say that wasn't the case. Now, with one paper, then there's that other perspective has been lost. So with Crosscut and KCTS, it's a little bit different because Crosscut is an organization where they are doing good work. They're also financially in the hole. And with KCTS acquiring them, that means that they will be able to actually have a higher profile. I would wager that there are a number of KCTS viewers that probably didn't even know what Crosscut was. So you have the ability to expand coverage, or Crosscut will have the ability to expand coverage through KCTS. On the other hand, it is distressing to see that KCTS is going to be reducing its coverage of news, from what I understand, to more of an interstitial level. So I think Crosscut will benefit. That's great. I wonder about what's going to happen in terms of coverage on KCTS.
By the way, I don't know how many KPLU reporters and producers and editors are coming to KUOW. KUOW has job openings and people at KPLU
right.
are applying, mm-hmm. and we'll see how it actually plays out, as you say. Rob McKenna, a big reason that newspapers and TV stations and radio stations consolidate is because we have a lot more choices now. So advertisers can reach consumers online. You can get information online. So overall, are we better served with information now than we were 20 years ago or worse?
Well, I think that it's certainly good that the quantity of information has increased, but I'm really concerned about whether the quality has been diminished proportionately. In other words, when you have fewer professional journalists covering stories, the quality of news is going to go down. Ask anyone who employs a press officer or puts out press releases, for example, state government press officers. They'll tell you that the amount of time now that their press releases are just cut and pasted into stories, typically online, is much greater than it used to be because you don't have the filter of a professional journalist. So I think the distressing thing about the loss of KPLU is it means that fewer of professional journalists reporting the news and applying their professional judgment in doing so. And I think there's no question, at least in my mind, that we've seen a decline in the quality of the information we have access to, the quality of the news, and a corresponding increase in the sort of point of view journalism, if you will, where you have less objectivity and more of an agenda, which is driving that news. So I think it's...
I'm not familiar with that kind of news coverage.
Yeah, if I could just think of a local example for a minute.
Maybe Seattle's only newspaper.
Well, one thing I will say in answer to that is that, yes, that is true. You will have... I've got to say, journalists have been leaving the profession for many years before... journalists are not the highest paid profession. After a while, as we were talking earlier about just income disparity, after a while, they decide that they're going to go and be paid, go into a prison, they'll get higher wages. So that's also an issue. But in terms of this, I would say, Rob, that yes, you're right. In terms of mainstream media, there are fewer people who are going into journalism from J school that are educated in ethics and reporting and really doing hard-hitting journalism. But I'll also say that a number of those journalists have also gone online to do some really amazing reporting for blogs, for online-only organizations. And I'll also say, I was talking to Bill Lurie about how I get my news. I get a lot of my news from the West Seattle blog. That is my local blog, and they're actually run by journalists. So if I want to find out what's going on in my neighborhood, a lot of times they'll tell me things that I haven't even heard on the news. And they do very, very, very great updated reporting. So I think it just depends on, yes, consolidation on a mainstream level. Yes, that is making the population a little poorer in terms of being able to have access to mainstream reporting. However, if you expand it out online, yeah, you are going to find a lot of opinionated and a lot of like repeated, like you said, just cut and paste from press releases. But there are also a lot of really wonderful online outfits that are doing some great work. So I don't want to disparage what those people are doing online.
Melanie McFarlane has written in newspapers with Wood Pulp. She writes online now, journalist, TV critic at McTelevision. Dan Savage, there's only one newspaper in Seattle, and Dan Savage is the editorial director. Just look at the masthead. It'll tell you that. Rob McKenna, there can only be one governor. Maybe it'll be Rob McKenna.
Ouch.
You're going to run again?
Unlikely.
Oh, okay. Rob McKenna, that was a dig. Former state attorney general. It's good to see you.
I'll come back anyway, Bill. It's okay.
Good. Good. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW, Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW's Week in Review. Rob McKenna will be back with us someday, and Dan Savage and Melanie McFarlane, I feel it. And KUOW getting better than ever. You believe me?
By
better than ever.
KPLU.
It's 1 o'clock.